Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sons of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the July 2025 issue. I'll begin with the essay, The Geological Sublime, Butterflies, Deep Time, and Climate Change, by Lewis Hyde. It is not inadmissible to think of an epoch, not too far distant, when humanity, to ensure its survival, will find itself reduced to desisting from any further making of history. Mircea Eliade. The earthquake shook us awake at 4:31 in the morning. We hurried into a closet while, for 15 seconds, it finished its business and the car alarms down on 3rd in California began their complaint. When we emerged, the night sky greeted us through a crack in the wall, and chunks of plaster sat smack on the Apple keyboard. The cat had fled. Out on the street, the hanging dust of rendered sheetrock mixed with the scent of potted plants, and for those of us standing in our nightclothes, a dose of adrenaline improved the sense of awe. Suddenly, the inhuman forces of the raw earth had struck us, forces that lift mountains and sink cities. And suddenly, there was a rip in time, a 20-heartbeat glimpse into the equally inhuman roll of ages where continents join and break apart. 30 miles north of our Santa Monica apartment, Oat Mountain had risen 15 inches and moved 6 inches to one side. That mountain sits in Southern California's transverse ranges, which began their rise from the sea about 5 million years ago, having first been caught some 15 million years earlier between tectonic plates that spun them clockwise, so they now sit at right angles to the coast. The geology of the transverse ranges consists largely of graphite from the Mesozoic era, 66 to 252 million years ago, with some even earlier Precambrian material at least 1.6 billion years old. These are large numbers. They belong to the calculus of deep time as introduced to the world by British scientists in the mid-19th century, namely the preeminent geologist of the age, Charles Lyell, and Charles Darwin, who borrowed Lyell's unbounded temporality and used it to underpin his theory of evolution. Long before he formulated that theory, Darwin himself had witnessed what he called the forces which slowly and by little starts uplift continents. The year was 1835, and Darwin was nearing the end of a 5-year journey around the world aboard the British surveying ship, the HMS Beagle. In Chile, he was on shore one February day taking a nap when the ground began to rock. The quake lasted 2 minutes. Its only local effect was to make Darwin almost giddy. Nearly 2 weeks later, he arrived in Concepcion to find a completely ruined city. After offering an inventory of all that was lost, Darwin, ever the student geologist, noted that the land around the Bay of Concepcion was upraised 2 or 3 feet, and that on the nearby island of Santa Maria, they found mussel shells still adhering to the rocks, 10 feet above high water mark. Later that month, Darwin climbed high into the Andes, where he found shells which were once crawling on the bottom of the sea, now standing nearly 14,000 feet above its level. It had taken about 25 million years for those shells to reach that height. For several years now, I have been reading these early theorists, thinking that their vision of geological and evolutionary time might give me a context for understanding not just the age of mountains, but something more current. It's one thing to hear the millions of years it took the Andes to rise. It's quite another to hear that in mere centuries, the oceans may reach levels of acidity not seen in 300 million years, or that the Earth is the hottest it has been in the past 125,000 years. These days, geological forces, formerly the stuff of earthquakes and volcanoes, have escaped the confines of deep time to present themselves daily, winter, spring, summer, and fall. It is on this other end of the scale of time, in seasons rather than eons, that my own interest in natural science began and where today it finds its focus and concern. As a child and to this day, one of my deepest pleasures has come from walking farm fields and alpine meadows, watching for butterflies, a pursuit that takes on a formal touch each year when, in early July, I join the annual Concord, Massachusetts Butterfly Count. 15 or 20 naturalists, most of us amateurs, gather and split into several teams to search a set list of local fields and woods. My group always begins in nearby Sudbury, where there's a colony of Appalachian browns. Not a rare butterfly, but one found only in wet woods, swamps, and bottomlands, a habitat I would have done well to read about before my first visit, when I waded into a field of tall sedges and spent the rest of the day in waterlogged shoes. By the end of last year's hunt, our four teams had seen 353 butterflies belonging to 29 species. Most common was the pearl crescent, 84, followed by the common wood nymph, 47, and a 19th century immigrant from Europe, the cabbage white, 39. At the bottom of the list lay the great spangled fritillary, the question mark, and the American painted lady, one each. It's hard to say what any one year's numbers mean. The weather varies, as do the number of volunteers, their taxonomic skill, and the time spent in the field. Habitats can change too. Should anyone drain that Sudbury shrub swamp, the Appalachian brown would disappear. But we have kept the count for decades now, and the trend is clear. In 35 years, the number of individual butterflies observed has dropped by more than half. The number of species has fallen by a third. A dozen butterflies are now missing, including the showy Baltimore checker spot and the Aphrodite fritillary, a large orange and black butterfly with amber eyes and light-catching silver spots on the underwing. The Aphrodite leaves its chrysalis in June, lays its eggs in late summer, and survives the winter as newly hatched larvae. Statewide, its population has fallen 90% in recent decades, most likely because those young larvae are more and more at risk of dying from dehydration now that snow cover is getting thinner and the seasons warmer. Daily observations need only the context of decades to yield their meaning, but the decades-long decline of the Aphrodite fritillary needs the context of deep time. In New England, one chapter of the deep time story was written 22,000 years ago, when a mile of glacial ice covered the land. A second chapter began when the last of that ice melted away and we entered the period we now call the Holocene, the time of recorded human history. As for butterflies, their subgroup within the Lepidoptera goes back more than 100 million years. Within that subgroup, the greater fritillaries belong to the genus Spieria, and the Spieria in turn belong to a family, the Nymphalidae, that goes back 90 million years. Given that the lifespan of insect species can exceed 1 million years, we can reasonably suppose that the now troubled Spieria Aphrodite has been greeting New England summers throughout the Holocene's 11,000 years. 11,000 years of survival versus a few decades of decline. It may not be clear how we are to reckon with spans of time so utterly out of proportion with one another, but that is now the task at hand as more species decline or go extinct. A sense of temporal proportion is what the climate crisis calls for, writes the geologist Marcia Bjornrud. A sense of the durations of the great chapters in Earth's history, of the rates of change during previous intervals of environmental instability, and of each of these in relation to present human time. She's right. To acquire that sense has been one of the goals of my reading over the past few years. And yet, even if we overcome our temporal illiteracy, we may still feel like that Mexican farmer who, in 1941, went out to tend his cornfield, only to find a volcano opening a fissure in his furrows and rising, eventually, bury his town in lava. How are we, who plant our corn in spring, who live with four-year election cycles and 30-year mortgages, how are we to position ourselves in relation to the inhuman forces that have been shaping the earth for 4.5 billion years and now seem to be accelerating? How, in short, shall we approach the climate crisis when the needed sense of proportion can be baffled by floods of geological time? As for the early theorists who first opened time's floodgates, my question has been whether they left us tools or stories that might help guide the present urgent work. How did Lyell and Darwin imagine and engage with deep time, and how might this be of service today? The first thing to say is that we were not unaware of the difficulty. Having dispensed with the common belief that the Earth was 6,000 years old, both men, nonetheless, often found themselves perplexed about how to speak of the vaster reaches of time they envisioned. In his primary work, the 3-volume Principles of Geology, Lyell is regularly vague, speaking of an indefinite lapse of ages, very remote eras, or time incalculably remote. Sometimes he speaks of millions, as when he's arguing against geologists who calculate using thousands of years when the language of nature signified millions. How many millions, he rarely says, although his numbers can reach dizzying heights. Truly primordial matters must be figured not just in millions, but in millions of ages, spans of time wherein all the epochs of geology taken together would constitute a mere moment of the past, a mere infinitesimal portion of eternity. Darwin's vision of deep time came almost entirely from Lyell. In 1831, at the start of that 5-year journey around the world, he carried with him the first volume of Principles and immediately applied his ideas to all he saw. Decades later, in On the Origin of Species, he tells his readers that any who have read Lyell and yet do not admit how incomprehensibly vast have been the past periods of time may at once close this volume. In a typical passage in The Voyage of the Beagle, he writes that the mind is stupefied when trying to think on the lapse of years needed to produce a 200-mile-wide bed of porphyry pebbles, or that it makes the head almost giddy to think of the years required for ocean tides to wear away 300 feet of solid rock. Such a case, he confesses elsewhere, impresses my mind almost in the same manner as does the vain endeavor to grapple with the idea of eternity. Neither Lyell nor Darwin ever disposed of time's incomprehensibility. Commendably, both men filled their work with regular professions of their own ignorance. Our capacities are finite, while the scheme of the universe may be infinite, notes Lyell at one point. The greater the circle of light, the greater the boundary of darkness by which it is surrounded. As for Darwin, his arguments in The Origin often end with a bow to our profound ignorance. In the book's final chapter, he concludes by saying that serious objections to his theory remain, but that they relate to questions on which we are confessedly ignorant, nor do we know how ignorant we are. Toward the beginning of Principles, Lyell recalls how his first encounter with the work of his predecessor, James Hutton, awakened in him a sense of the sublime, of awe mixed with a painful sense of our incapacity to conceive a plan of such infinite extent. As I tracked how Lyell wrestles with times incalculably remote, the first thing that surprised me was his attraction to an ancient idea that the planet's history could be told in terms of recurrent eras, in which millennia of summer warmth and millennia of winter chill follow endlessly, one after the other, in what used to be called an annus magnus, or great year. For Lyell, the scientist, geology itself seemed to offer confirmation. The fossil record proved that in earlier ages, much of the northern hemisphere had been tropical, and then, for ages since, it hadn't. How did that come to be? Could it happen again? Lyle answers by proposing that large climatic changes arise when volcanoes and earthquakes alter the distribution of land and sea. The winter of the Great Year might descend upon Europe and the open seas turn icy if, he says, the hills of Italy were to sink, while at the same time an equivalent extent of land were to rise from the Arctic Ocean north of Siberia. As for the geological Great Summer, all signs of frost should disappear from the earth if land were to rise in the torrid zone and waters flood the North Pole. Then prehistoric creatures now extinct might once again roam the earth. The huge iguanodon might reappear in the woods, and the ichthyosaur in the sea, while the pterodactyl might flit again through umbrageous groves of tree ferns. If this matter of the Great Year was the first surprise when I began to read Lyle, a second came when he moves from the first volume of Principles, in which he shows how small geological changes, repeated constantly over vast periods of time, can produce huge results, to the second volume, where he focuses on the organic realm. Are not species, he asks, similarly capable, as some naturalists pretend, of being indefinitely modified in the course of a long series of generations? Jean-Baptiste Lamarck was the pretending naturalist he had in mind, having already famously argued for the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Lyle did not agree. No new species comes into being by transmutation from another, he argued. Each is stable, endowed at the time of its creation, with all the features by which it is now distinguished. And yet the fossil record gave clear evidence that species do not last forever, stable as they may be. As for how, if that's the case, new species arise to replace the lost, nowhere in his geology does Lyle offer an explanation. In his private letters, however, there is an answer. Under the presiding mind, a succession of extinction of species and creation of new ones is going on perpetually. Lyle calls that idea the grandest which he had ever conceived, and indeed it was, because it allowed him to harmonize his geology with his religion. Among the beetle-collecting country parsons of his day, it was often assumed that the world had been created 6,000 years ago and that many geological anomalies could be explained by Noah's flood. Lyle was a scientist, however, not a parson, and he had found that floods of time offered greater insight than floods of water. At the same time, he was a believing Christian, and even as he willingly dispensed with Noah and Genesis 6 through 9, he held firm to the special creation of humankind as figured in Genesis 1. Mircea Eliade's The Myth of the Eternal Return has helped me understand Lyle's reluctance to extend to organic life the incremental temporality that gives his geology such explanatory power. Eliade's book is built around the contrast between time as figured in the myth of his title and time as history. History, in this context, is a series of unforeseeable and irreversible events, while in Eternal Return, events proceed like the phases of the moon, ceaselessly and predictably manifesting what came before and will come again. Those who hold to such a myth, Eliade writes, may be aware of history, but will strive to ignore it, attending instead to the beginnings of things, to the great time. Out of that refusal of profane time in favor of trans-historical events comes a certain valorization of human existence. Our lives and ideals matter because they belong to things eternal. For Lyle, the material and the organic worlds belong to categorically distant temporal orders. For mountains and rivers, time is history, sequential and irreversible. For species, it isn't. Lyle joins the ancients in mapping periods of creation and destruction onto the Great Year. leaving open the possibility that the pterodactyl might even one day fly again. Some cultures, Eliade shows, preserve their eternals by simply denying the force of history. In Lyell's case, the culture at hand was Christianity, and the ideal was the unique status of humankind. To the end of his days, Lyell resisted any natural history that implied that human beings might have descended from one of the inferior animals. Eventually, Lyell abandoned the hope that prehistoric megafauna would reappear, and by the 1860s, he finally assented to the gist of Darwin's theory, an indispensable hypothesis, while continuing to assert the sovereignty of the divine mind. Charles Darwin had no trouble discarding Adam and Eve, but that did not dispose of a problem he shared with Lyell: how to build a theory when a key element, the apparent infinity of time, defies comprehension. By my reading, several strategies arose. The first was to split infinity into tiny pieces, spans of time short enough to understand and work with. That is to say, Lyell and Darwin invented a kind of integral calculus, a method of adding together a series of infinitesimals of minute changes that can, over the lapse of ages, produce huge consequences. Minute after minute, little waves hit a granite cliff, or year after year, the wings of pigeons vary slightly. Then, in the fullness of time, a wide pebble beach replaces the cliff, and a pigeon with an astounding fantail replaces its ancestor. Or even, after an accumulation of infinitesimally small inherited modifications, over an almost infinite number of generations, a bird appears that is not a pigeon at all, but an entirely new species. A second strategy begins with the obvious fact that the geological record has distinct periods. A cliff by the seashore reveals layers of limestone, sandstone, and cobbles, each presumably a distinct chapter in the history of the Earth. If the years it took to write each chapter could be determined, then it would be easier to speak of those otherwise very remote eras. It was not until the 20th century that tools sufficient to the task were developed. A key advance came in 1905, when Ernest Rutherford showed that radioactivity decays exponentially, and therefore that uranium-bearing rocks can be used as natural clocks. That and a score of other insights mean that we can now say with some confidence, for example, that the Cambrian began 538.8 million years ago. As for steps that could be taken in the 19th century, Lyell managed to invent a cunning way to determine the relative age of geological strata. Counting fossilized mollusks, he compared the number matching still living species with the number now extinct. The larger the proportion of extinct species, the older that stratum. It was an ingenious way of ordering geological periods, but it left the duration of each one still undefined. In The Origin, Darwin took his own stab at trading in time incomprehensibly vast for actual numbers. Near his home in Kent, there were two prominent ridges, the North and South Downs. Between them lay an expanse of woodlands and heathlands known as the Weald. The Downs are what now remain of a prehistoric dome of chalk, sandstone, and clay, the top of which has eroded away. How long did that erosion take? Darwin notes that the Weald Basin is about 1,000 feet deep and 22 miles wide. Assuming, among other things, that all the stone and sand that once filled it had been carried away at a rate of 1 inch per century, he concludes that the denudation of the Weald must have required 306,662,400 years, or say, 300 million years. Geologists say that the chalk dome began to form 30 million years ago, making Darwin's number at least 10 times too big. But even if that is a better estimate than 300, I don't believe that more precise periodization will ever dispense with the mystery of deep time. Saying that the Andes took 25 million years to rise, or that the granite in California's transverse ranges is more than 66 million years old, implies that we've got a handle on time, that we've domesticated it, so to speak, brought it into the house of science and made it familiar rather than strange. But neither a chart of geology's eons, eras, and periods, nor a calculus of infinitesimals can eliminate a sense of awe in the face of geological time. Darwin, as far as I can see, never lost his. In The Origin, it's just before his analysis of the Weald that he says that all such geological wonders impress his mind, as does the vain endeavor to grapple with the idea of eternity. And when he's finished with his experiment in periodization, he immediately returns to his sense of wonder. What an infinite number of generations, which the mind cannot grasp, must have succeeded each other in the long roll of years. Some of that geological awe has now been added to my childhood delight in butterflies, for there are fossil Lepidoptera. In Colorado, the Green River Formation has yielded at least four specimens from 48 million years ago during the Eocene, and the nearby Florissant Formation a dozen species 13 million years later. Such clearly dated periodization may be easier to grasp than the idea of eternity, but even so, it should leave untouched the initial wonder that butterflies exist and survive, proof of what nature can do with life when offered a chance to play with flowering plants, sunlight, and air. One of New Hampshire's most curious butterflies may be called a living fossil, a surviving relic of the Ice Age. By nature, an Arctic species, Enesis melissa, or the Melissa arctic, was widespread during the wintry centuries that followed the retreat of the last glaciers. About 10,000 years ago, however, as the world warmed toward modern temperatures, the species retreated to high mountains and to far northern latitudes. One group took refuge in the alpine meadows of the White Mountains, where they have been isolated ever since, so long, in fact, that they've evolved into a subspecies, Enesis melissa semidea. I've seen this butterfly only once. It was a June day, and I drove the Mount Washington toll road from Pinkham Notch up 4,000 feet to a spot where I was able to hike on level ground across the Alpine Garden Trail. The spring flowers, not the butterflies, were the meadow's first revelation, trailing mats of pink azalea, fields of yellow mountain avens, and colonies of tiny white-flowered sandwort, another Ice Age refugee. Distracted at first by the flower show, I snapped to attention only when something small and dark flew past, dropped to the ground, and disappeared, as if swallowed up by the scattered stones. The field guides described this butterfly, not very helpfully, as smoky or feebly marked. Long ago, the dean of 19th century Lepidopterus, Samuel Scudder, took a stab at a fuller description, but the result was more muddled than clear, with a grayish ochraceous and a grayish white, though both can be obscured by a blackish brown. Suffice it to say that this butterfly has evolved cryptic coloration so as to hide among the equally cryptic surfaces of the alpine landscape. The stones of Mount Washington, admittedly, have a bit more color than the Melissa arctic, but they have the same mottled patterning, their weathered skins a maze of blackish brown and grayish green lichens and moss, touched occasionally with ochre highlights, the whole nicely broken up by webs of tiny fractures where the summer sun has dried things out. The butterfly I saw that day had a habit, when it landed, of letting the wind tip it over so that the underwings lay flat against the stone, a mottled creature taking refuge in the mottled world. And I began to feel that this animal was teaching me not just to see it, but to see the stones. It was a schooling in discernment, in the art of recognition. You are listening to an essay, The Geological Sublime, Butterflies, Deep Time, and Climate Change, by Lewis Hyde, from the July 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I once asked a friend why he was so dedicated to watching birds, and he replied simply, Darshan. In Indian religions, Darshan refers to the auspicious sight of a divinity or great teacher. More widely, it has come to mean any glimpse of the marvelous or awe-inspiring, the cougar watching the hiker, the invisible butterfly suddenly in focus. Darshan means getting a view, said Gary Snyder. If the clouds blow away, as they did once for me, and you get a view of the Himalayas from the foothills, an in-person would say, ah, the Himalayas are giving you their darshan. They're letting you have their view. So it was that June day when the Melissa Arctic gave me a view of things both singular and collective. Butterfly and stone, moss and lichen, spring flowers, and the mountain rising above us. At the end of the 19th century, Scudder reported that the Melissa Arctic was exceedingly abundant. During the entire month of July, the butterflies swarm over the rocks and sedgy plateaus of the upper summits. These days, the butterfly is found in only 3 or 4 of the White Mountain meadows, the population estimated at 1,500 individuals in each yearly brood. Annual temperatures in New England are now predicted to rise between 5 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit by century's end, a change greater than any in the past 10,000 years. When that happens, all the high meadow remnants of the Ice Age will be pushed off the top of the mountain and disappear. The ship that carried Charles Darwin around the world in the 1830s housed more than 20 chronometers in their own special cabin. They were used, along with astronomical observation, to determine the ship's location and thus to draw an accurate map of the voyage, or, as Darwin more boldly puts it, to complete the chronometrical measurement of the world. Marine chronometers are set to faithfully indicate the solar time at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, London. Their uses are not like those of the common kitchen clock because they are built to travel. The kitchen clock and the chronometer circling the globe offer two kinds of temporal awareness, one fitted to the body, the other to the mind. At home we watch the sun move, and when it hangs directly overhead, are pleased to hear the clock strike the bell for lunch. Chronometrical time, however, applies Greenwich time to the globe as a whole, and any harmony between time and the body is lost. At home, the sun sets once a day. In a chronometrical world, the sun never sets and never stops rising either. Time in that empire is disembodied, a thing more imagined than felt. Neither Lyell nor Darwin measured time on a human scale. It didn't take days, months, or even calendar years for Mount Etna to rise or for the animals of the Galapagos to become unique species. These things now have their daily and seasonal rhythms, but the temporality of their arising belongs to another order, one that the 19th century was just beginning to chart. Once solar time in Greenwich had been carried, night and day, around the spinning globe, time became highly abstracted, cut away from its animal home so as to be more easily figured both geologically and evolutionarily. Darwin regularly distinguishes what our senses directly tell us from what our reason already knows. In 1836, the HMS Beagle arrived at the Cocos Islands, where a low atoll of coral encircled a miles-wide lagoon. Why did these islands stand in a ring? Because, Darwin argues, the coral had grown around the slopes of a slowly sinking volcano. We may be astounded, he writes, by the monumental works of humankind, but how utterly insignificant are the greatest of these when compared to these mountains of stone accumulated by the agency of various minute and tender animals. As if to offer a gloss on his exclamation point, Darwin then divides his awareness into two parts. This is a wonder which does not at first strike the eye of the body, but, after reflection, the eye of reason. The Eye of Reason can travel far beyond the bounds of present time and space. If we look at a barrier reef and imagine seeing a mountain rise, a mountain sink, and coral slowly grow, we may thus, like unto a geologist who had lived his 10,000 years and kept a record of the passing changes, gain some insight into the great system by which the surface of this globe has been broken up and land and water interchanged. A 10,000-year-old geologist! We are at one of those points where scientific explanation finds it useful to partner with mythology. The eye of the mortal body can see a slow-growing coral reef, but only the fantastic eye of reason can apprehend the vast reaches of time that are its maker. Its maker? To imply some agency at work may be an odd way of speaking, but it's one that Darwin's language suggests in both the voyage and the origin, where time begins to appear as a thing with its own powers, a creator of some sort, one that cannot be comprehended by the human mind except, perhaps, by beginning with its very incomprehensibility. There's a moment in the final pages of the voyage when Darwin implies that his apprehension of the magnitude of time comes to him through a kind of via negativa, that desert father's practice of seeking God by stripping away all that is comprehensible and then watching to see what remains. A desert sufficient to that purpose Darwin found in southernmost South America. The plains of Patagonia can be described only by negative characters, without habitations, without water, without trees, without mountains. They support merely a few dwarf plants. Why, then, have these arid wastes taken so firm a hold on my memory? It must be partly owing to the free scope given to the imagination. The plains of Patagonia are boundless and hence unknown. They bear the stamp of having lasted, as they are now, for ages, and there appears no limit to their duration through future time. It was the sense of awe in the face of the temporal sublime and passages like this one that had me thinking that time, or rather, time with a capital T, in Darwin sometimes appears as a kind of divinity. Not a god like the one Charles Lyell knew from his Bible, more like those he would have known from his reading of Sanskrit and Greek. The Hindu Trimurti, for example, a three-faced triad of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, bound into a single figure of creation and destruction, or the Greek Cronus, last born of the Titans, who in antiquity became a god of time and brought the animal creation into order. We should approach such powers with caution. There is a classic Greek concept, eidos, often translated as shame, but in fact carrying an instructively wide range of meanings. In terms of self-restraint, eidos can mean modesty and regard for others. It can also mean reverence and awe. When you enter the grove of a god or meet a true poet or prophet, these several feelings should arise as one: awe, reverence, and the kind of inhibitory shame that keeps you from doing or saying anything profane or sacrilegious. The person who has no inborn sense of eidos, who can neither sense nor respect the force field surrounding the great powers, is in danger. In the case at hand, they who shamelessly toy with the titan of time may well be destroyed. The feminist philosophers Donna Haraway and Isabel Stengers argue that, when it comes to the current geological period, we should focus not on what humankind has done to the earth, but on what the earth is doing in response. The earth in this context is Gaia, a complex and synergistic being, and the present era in which Gaia is intruding upon human activity should be called the Cthulhucene, not the Anthropocene. Cthulhucene derives from the Greek chthon, earth, and chthonic powers are those associated with volcanoes, earthquakes, caves, and all that lies in the depths below. Greek myths feature dozens of chthonic divinities and forces. Iacus, a judge of the dead, and Thanatos, winged demon of earth, are chthonic. Hermes, in his office as guide of souls, is Hermes Chthonios. Persephone in her winter phase is Persephone Chthonia. As for the chthonic powers who might intrude upon us, the worst must be the Titans, primeval offspring of Gaia and Uranus, earth and sky. In the Greek succession myth, the Titans overthrew their father, Uranus, and Zeus in turn overthrew the Titans, confining them to the bronze-walled prison of Tartarus, that black and stormy pit that lies lower even than the depths of Hades. To describe our era as the Cthulhu scene is to recognize that Gaia is responding to our having released such titanic forces from their confinement. 100-year floods, forest fires the size of nations, record-breaking heat waves. Chthonic forces now mess with our affairs as they haven't since the glaciers last descended from the poles. Surely among the most threatening sources of such powers are the fossil fuels now released from the depths. In her book on George Orwell, Rebecca Solnit ends a chapter touching on coal mining with a citation from a 1930 primer on the first Soviet five-year plan. The remains of the swamp grass, the ferns, the horsetails rotted under the layers of sand and clay become black and turned into coal, it reads, declaring that to this cemetery we intend to go, drag the dead out of their tombs, and force them to work for us. The era when those dead were alive, the Carboniferous, spanned 60 million years. Today, the coal fields of the Industrial Revolution contain 60 million years of plant-captured sunlight, infinitesimal drops of energy gathered day by day, and then petrified over near infinities of time. To burn them over the course of a few centuries amounts to treating human time to a blast of geological time, an earthquake of time. It was 1836 when Darwin wrote of the Eye of Reason, having been immersed in principles of geology for more than 4 years and learning to see the world through Lyell's eyes. I feel as if my books came half out of Sir Charles Lyell's brain, he would later remark. The great merit of the principles was that it altered the whole tone of one's mind, and therefore that when seeing a thing never seen by Lyell, one yet saw it partially through his eyes. Darwin's ideas about coral islands are his own, but it was what he borrowed from the genius of Lyell's Eye of Reason that made them possible. One thing that I myself have borrowed from Lyell, somewhat to my own surprise, is his Great Year and its myth of eternal return, a remnant of which I find worth saving if it could be cut to a more modest size. As the Earth's wobbling axis rotates through the signs of the zodiac, the age of Aquarius will end, but it's comforting to know that, in the fullness of time, it will return. It would be more comforting still were the time involved not so utterly inhuman. As for human time, I look to the 5,000 or 6,000 years since human civilization arose. Compared with earlier chapters in the history of the Earth, ours have been millennia with a relatively stable climate. It has varied, to be sure, but never as punishingly as during the Ice Age, and because a stable climate slows the hand of evolution, animal and plant species have been relatively stable as well, eternally returning, generation upon generation. Eternally? Yes, for there are many eternities once eternity is understood to be a category of human thought. Viewed from the brevity of human life, there is little difference between the 3,600 years since the Shang Dynasty arose, the 11,700 years since the glaciers melted, and the 100 million years since the first butterflies took wing. All are equally eternal, and the animal phyla that have been with us, essentially unchanged for all those years, the birds and mammals, clams and snails, spiders and insects, these are, to me, surviving embodiments of eternal return. Defending his belief in the fixity of species and principles, Lyell turned to the recent discovery that the priests of Egypt had bequeathed to us in their cemeteries embalmed bodies of consecrated animals, bulls, cats, dogs, apes, crocodiles, and more. The cats especially interested Lyle, since during the 3,000 years that followed their entombment, their progeny had been dispersed over the whole earth, and yet had not undergone any perceptible mutation. The cat is still the same animal which was held sacred by the Egyptians. In later years, Lyell acknowledged that he had been wrong about how long it would take to evolve a new species. 30 or 40 centuries are insignificant. But he was right about the stability of cats in the time since the Egyptians built their pyramids. In human time, if history means the irreversible and unforeseen, then the species Felis catus hardly belongs to history. To this day, the meanest alley cat in London testifies to the eternal return of cat life. As for butterflies, consider the Red Admiral. Bright orange-red bands across dark wings, touches of blue and white, a common species with an ancient and stable lineage. It not only appears faithfully rendered in 400-year-old Dutch paintings, but ancestors of its genus lie well-preserved in the Eocene fossil beds of Colorado. To this day, they fly in concord, 5 of them during last year's count, testifying to the eternal return of butterfly life. I take Lyle's interest in the great year to be an illustration of Eliade's point that some cultures protect their eternal ideals by simply resisting history. In Lyle's case, the ideal was humanity's spark of the divine, and the history to be resisted was the natural history, now called evolution. In my case, the eternals I wish to defend are the species with which we've shared the planet since before the Egyptians wrapped their mummies. As for history, the point is not so much to resist it as to understand that we choose whether or not to make it. Let us not forget our ignorance, nor the limits of our foresight. There is no stopping the arrow of time when it comes to earthquakes and glaciers. But in human affairs, it is we who string the bow that lets the arrow fly. As for what stays with me after having seen the world through Darwin's eyes, I think of a time when, while first reading The Origin, I took a break and stood in our garden watching the bees nuzzle the peonies. It was late in May. Their legs were yellow, pouched with pollen, and for the first time it occurred to me that I was seeing the fruits of deep time. Not just the bees and the flowers, but their mutualism, and the peony leaves feeding on sunlight, and the earthworms aerating the soil beneath. For a long time after, everything I saw seemed to be made of time, or by time, or in time. And not just the cheery pollinators, but the red-tailed hawk rendering the stringy meat of its kill, and the COVID virus that settled in my throat, Christmas 2021, late variant of some ancestor virus, an embodiment of the time it takes to work up such a cunning art of massive replication. As for the amber stream pouring into my gas tank as I stand at the self-service pump on my way to Walden, I now take it and all the other plant-based fossil fuels to be an infinity of petrified sunlight, best understood through the compound lens of the Lyell Darwin eye. Lewis Hyde's most recent book, A Primer for Forgetting, was published in 2019 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This essay is part of a series supported by the John Templeton Foundation. Next, I'll be reading a piece from the 2007 archive titled Doctored Results by Gary Greenberg. Once upon a time, the scientific explanation for depression sounded something like this. If one listens patiently to a melancholiac's many and various self-accusations, one cannot in the end avoid the impression that often the most violent of them fits someone else, someone whom the patient loves, has loved, or should love. The self-reproaches are reproaches against a loved object which have been shifted away from it onto the patient's ego. For a modernist like Sigmund Freud, who wrote Mourning and Melancholia in 1917, depression was embedded in history, personal and cultural. And untangling that history rescuing it from the oblivion of the unconscious by turning it into a coherent story was the key to a cure. But his fascinating and tragic notion that we carry within us another whom we can never fully know, but whom we must try to know, is now headed for the dustbin of history. Freud, with his extravagant hermeneutics, his because-I-said-so epistemology, his unfalsifiable claims, not to mention the sheer inefficiency of psychoanalysis, has given way to the doctors of the world with their inventories and brain scans and pills. They have replaced Freud's unconscious, the repository of that which is too much to bear and which will stop tormenting us only to the extent that we give it language, with an unconscious populated by carbon and hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen, the basic building blocks of the material world, essential, but forever dumb. Still, I'm not exactly pining for Freud at the Depression Clinical and Research Program of the Massachusetts General. This is the heart of the magic factory where I have met the criteria for a study that the hospital is running on pharmaceutical treatments for a major depression and where medicine is infused with the miracles of science. Except I never use the term magic factory with the doctors. You wouldn't want to seem paranoid in a place like this. Though I had my suspicions of the drug industry. Not that diseases care whether you believe in them. What matters is the evidence. How much insulin is in the blood, or how much sugar in the urine, and all the other ways nature has of telling you something is wrong. And yet there is no lab to send my bodily fluids to in order to assay my level of depression. Out on the street, blinking in the noonday sun, I peer into the brown paper bag they've given me. The study medicine comes in a pair of plastic bottles stuffed with 2 weeks' worth of glistening amber gel caps. They look just like regular prescription drugs, but for the sticker that says drug limited by federal law to investigational use. That seems a little dramatic for fish oil, something I can get at my health food store or by eating however much salmon it would take to provide 2 grams of omega-3s per day. But under the agreement we've made that they are doctors, I am sick, and must turn myself over to them so they can cure me, the medicine must be treated with the reverence due a communion wafer. Make a sudden decision to duck into a restaurant, to order a glass of water with my meal, to start the trial not tomorrow morning as I meant to, but now. I cannot resist the temptation to lay down my pessimism at this altar, to put myself in the hands of these doctors, to take their investigational drug and let them cure me of myself. I gulp down my 6 golden pills. From Manufacturing Depression, which appeared in the May 2007 issue of Harper's Magazine, the complete article, along with the magazine's entire 175-year archive, is available online at harpers.org/archive. I'll conclude today with findings. Danish scientists suggested that adults abstaining from all other meat can eat 9/10 of 2 chicken breasts a week without exceeding planetary boundaries. A 4 degrees Celsius warming scenario was projected to cause a 40% loss to global GDP by 2100, and 111 fossil fuel companies were linked to $28 trillion in lost productivity or incurred damage arising from climate change between 1991 and 2020. The universe may rotate at a rate of 2 turns every trillion years. An enormous cloud of molecular hydrogen, which may be in the process of star formation, was discovered 300 light years from Earth. An Egyptologist who examined depictions of the sky goddess Nut bending over her brother and father, drawn from 555 ancient coffins, theorized that the version on the outer coffin of Nesetaujataket, a chantress to Amun-Re, represents the great rift that runs through the Milky Way as a dark line running through Nut's starry body. The star manual of Master Shai may predate the star catalog of Hipparchus. Jupiter's hailstorms precipitate mush balls of ammonia. Dipteryx oleifera trees thrive after direct lightning strikes, which rid them of parasitic vines. Babies born in Portland, Oregon, have an additional 50 grams of birth weight when their mothers live within 100 meters of at least 10 trees. Makake mothers who lose an infant exhibit a period of protest but, unlike human mothers, do not subsequently exhibit despair. Lemur species of the genus Ulemur that are more sexually egalitarian possess more oxytocin receptors in their amygdalae as compared with species whose females routinely bully and dominate males. A survey of 1,786 conflicts between male and female Congolese bonobos revealed that 61% were won by females, who form coalitions to drive males into submission. Bite marks on the skeleton of a Yorkshire gladiator were found to be evidence of death by lion. A helicopter crash in South Africa was determined to have been caused by an unsecured penguin from Bird Island falling onto the cyclic pitch controller. Authorities seized four lions who arrived in Israel by drone. Life expectancy in Gaza fell by 34.9 years between October 2023 and September 2024, and the probability of death in childhood increased sixfold from 2022 to 2023. Among Israeli irritable bowel syndrome sufferers, Jews have more diarrhea, whereas Arabs have more constipation. Religious scrupulosity in youth may be difficult to disentangle from OCD. When depleted of other energy sources, the brains of marathon runners consume their own myelin. Those are all the findings we have time for now. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of readings from the July 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll tune in again next time.